Now, mention the words Black Panther, and you might think of the Black Empowerment group that was active in the late 60s and 70s. But before the political group, Black Panther was the first Black superhero in mainstream American comics. Now, more than 40 years later, the superhero is back in a new animated TV and DVD series based on the original comic. The 12-episode series is a partnership between Marvel Knights Animation and the cable network BET. It is inspired by a graphic novel written by filmmaker and former president of entertainment for BET Network's Reginald Hudlin. And Reginald Hudlin is with us now from our studios at NPR West. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you're too young to have been a devotee of the original Black Panther, I think. So how did you get interested in it?
That is not true. My older brother would bring home copies. He would not let me touch them unless I washed my hands first. But I grew up reading Fantastic Four 52, which was the debut of the Black Panther.
Okay, so you did know about it from childhood. So what made you want to do this new version of the series?
Well, the amazing thing about the Black Panther is, first of all, the Black Panther comic book in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense debuted in the same year, in 1966. So you have these brothers in Oakland and these two Jewish guys in New York who have the same brilliant idea at the same time, which is Black Panther is a very cool name.
True.
And the Black Panther superhero is a perfect idea. He's an African king who's also a superhero. He has this technologically advanced country that is completely independent. He's wealthy. He's intelligent. He's brave and strong. He's as perfect a creation as Superman or Batman or any of the great comic book characters.
Yeah, can I just ask, I think what I'm wondering is, did you always have this idea rattling around in your head that this is something you wanted to do something with at some point? Or was there a eureka moment for you that made you think, yes, now is the time?
I always wanted to write comic books. And the irony is, it's easier to break into film and television than it is to break into the comic book business. So after years of success in film and television, I got to get a meeting at Marvel, and I told them about my passion. And they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to write Black Panther. So I left that meeting with a job.
Okay, well, here it is. Let's play a clip from the first episode. This is where Black Panther encounters Captain America in his kingdom of Wakanda. This is just after the end of World War II. Let's play a short clip. Here it is.
Maybe you just lop off the head of every newcomer who hits town.
If we did that, you wouldn't have yours.
But those Nazis were here for a reason.
Yes, to steal our vibranium, the mineral that can only be found here in Wakanda. Hitler needs it for the next generation of their missile systems, as do you.
These are dangerous times. You need to choose a side.
We have our own.
So I want to mention that you've got some big-name talent voicing the characters. The voice of Black Panther is that of the Academy Award-nominated actor Djimon Hounsou, originally from Benin in West Africa. You've also got Kerry Washington, Alfre Woodard, the singer Jill Scott. That must have been fun. Was it hard to get people to participate in this? Or was this one of those things where people said the same thing as you, which is, oh, no-brainer, let me in?
Fortunately, it was the latter. I approached Djimon first, and Djimon said, yes, I've been tracking this project. So he was immediately on board and enthusiastic. Same with Kerry Washington, who's a dear friend of mine. Alfre Woodard, another dear friend of mine. My favorite story is actually from Jill Scott, who is, of course, very well known as a singer, but also as an actress. She was in an HBO series playing an African detective. And so when I approached her about playing Storm in the animated series, she said, you know, when I was a kid, I made a list of things, of goals, and one of them was to play Storm. So I'm happy you called, but I'm not surprised.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm speaking with Reginald Hudlin, the creator of a new animated series based on the comic superhero, The Black Panther. Now, the series to this point has aired on Australia TV. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Is it slated for a U.S. appearance?
It is not. It's actually, when we created the series, it's sold in a lot of territories all over the world. But right now, BET has the rights to air it in the U.S. And when we originally produced the series, in the time in between, they've changed programming direction. And they're saying that the show is too male and too young for their audience.
I am curious about who you think will be interested in it.
Well, I can tell you in the U.S. because we've released it on DVD for about a month now, and it is one of the fastest-selling DVDs in Marvel history. You know, it's outselling similar DVDs from about X-Men and Iron Man. And those are characters who've had major feature films, but Black Panther is selling faster than in both of those.
But it is curious, though, that you haven't found yet a distribution platform, you know, over the air. I mean, I think some might argue that it is violent. I think it's rather violent. I don't know if you think so, but it is not more violent than a number of video games that are widely available and are shown. I'm just wondering if you have an opinion about why there hasn't been a broadcast or cable distribution yet.
Well, I mean, most animated shows on television, they fall into two categories. One of them is programming for children. And as you said, this is a little sophisticated in terms of the violence, in terms of some of the political stuff. And most of the adult-oriented stuff tends to be family comedy, a la The Simpsons, Family Guy, The Cleveland Show, things like that. This is a different kind of thing. It is dramatic. It is, you know, politically provocative. And all those things, I think, are a plus, and which is why it's been a huge success to a very, very broad audience. I have to say that the reviews have been uniformly enthusiastic. Again, the sales have been great. The first week we sold out in stores all over the country. So the question isn't, is it something that people want to see? Because the numbers speak for themselves. The DVD is selling incredibly well.
Yes, you mentioned that about three or four times. Thank you,
I'm
Reginald.
Sorry.
Nicely
I'm sorry.
Done. But
no, because I emphasize that only to say that one of the most frustrating things is that there's this so-called convention of wisdom about black superheroes, that black comic books don't sell and black superheroes don't sell. And a lot of the battle for black creators is overcoming these really erroneous presumptions. And, for example, look at Blade. Blade has had three movies, each of whom have made over $100 million. But Blade comic books don't sell. So you go, well, is there a problem with the character? Well, no. Is there a problem with the audience? No, clearly there's an audience. There's a disconnect between getting the audience that wants to see it access to this character. And that is the frustrating thing when you do something like the Black Panther, because you know there's an audience, and when the audience does get a chance to grab it, they're very enthusiastic. I talk to parents who actually, when they have the I wrote the comic book as well, they would read the comic book to their kids at night, like a bedtime story. I know adults who said, look, forget my kids, I just want to watch this. And it's not a male-female thing. It's not a black, white, Latin, Asian thing. I have talked to 40-year-old white men who said, I dressed up as Black Panther when I was 7 years old for Halloween. So it's a very broad audience. Whatever you think might be the stumbling blocks aren't really there.
So we know what your costume will be for this Halloween. but before we let you go, you mentioned that when the original Black Panther came out, it came out at the same time, that the original comic, it came out at the same time that the movement, the political movement was born, and it clearly was some sort of a resonance. What is it you think people are responding to now in your series?
Well, I think, you know, the idea of an uncompromised, unabashedly heroic black man. I mean, black men get a lot of bashing in the press. At the same time, there's so many heroes from in popular media, from Sidney Poitier to Denzel Washington to Will Smith. And I think there's a tremendous hunger from all audiences for a black superhero. Not an anti-hero, but a hero. A guy who is independent, who stands on his own feet. The same way we cheer for the independence movements that's happening throughout Africa and the Middle East, because you see people standing up and fighting for what's right. The Black Panther represents those ideals played out on a big, fantastic scale.
Reginald Hudlin is one of the creators of the animated series The Black Panther. He's a filmmaker. He's also the former president of entertainment for the cable network BET. He was with us from NPR West. Reginald Hudlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about the Black Panther series, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org and click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. On the program today, we go around the world to get updates from Haiti, where another former dictator says he is heading back to the country in advance of Sunday's runoff elections, and to North Africa, where the ongoing unrest is taking a dramatic turn. But first, to Japan, where the official death toll has risen to more than 3,300 people following last week's devastating earthquake and tsunami off Japan's northeastern coast. That number is expected to rise in the days ahead, and in the meantime, survivors need everything, food, water, and shelter. In a few minutes, we'll hear about what the international community, especially the Red Cross, is doing to help. And the nuclear crisis continues. Authorities have told residents within an 18-mile radius of the quake-damaged Fukushima nuclear power plant to stay indoors. We turn now to someone with family ties near the power plant. His name is Paul Ogata. He's a Japanese-American comedian born and raised in Hawaii, but he lives in Los Angeles now, and he's with us from NPR West. Paul Ogata, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Have you been able to reach family in the Fukushima region, and how are they?
They're doing okay. There's one cousin we haven't heard from yet, but mostly everyone else is they're safe right now.
Well, obviously this is a tragedy for the world, but for people who have family and ties to the region, it obviously hits home in a particularly hard. May I ask how you are doing and reacting to all this?
Well, it's been a rough several days since the tsunami and the earthquake happened. Personally, I think I've lost some weight just stressing about what's going on in the world. But I have faith that mankind is better than this, and we will find a way to help all of our friends out, no matter where they are.
Now, we mentioned before that you're a comedian, and you were also part of a benefit last night at the Laugh Factory in Los Angeles called Stand Up for Japan. The first thing I wanted to ask is, obviously, I want to know how things went, but I'm wondering if, you know, Japan is an affluent country. It's the third largest economy in the world, and obviously this is a devastating tragedy of tremendous proportions, but has it been hard to make the case that the international community or people outside Japan need to actually help?
I don't think it's been difficult at all. All you have to do is look at the newspaper, turn on the TV, pop on the internet to see images of pure and total destruction and the lives that have been changed and erased. And it's really a no-brainer to get off your couch and help out in whatever way you can.
Was it hard to think about what to joke about at a time like this?
Well, yes and no. As comedians, that's what we do. We poke at the balloon to deflate it. So you do have to call out the 800-pound gorilla in the room and say that, yes, we're all here for the reason of helping Japan out with their tragedy right now. And then you move on. And I think the show went rather well last night. It was a very fun night.
What was your best moment? What was your best joke, if I can ask you that?
You know what? As a Japanese-American, it's... You grow up very emotionless, and so it was interesting to see how the Japanese public reacted, queuing up, lining up patiently, politely in lines, waiting for food and water, and that's just, it's in their culture. Whereas here in L.A., this city burns when the basketball team wins. You know, that's the kind of difference we have culturally.
Okay, well, that's a good one. That's a good one. But, you know, to that point, I did want to ask, a trauma of this magnitude. In the United States, many people are still dealing with the fallout from Hurricane Katrina, years before, and the ramifications of that are still being felt. And I wonder, forgive me, I know you're not an expert in this area, but what effect do you think that this will have on people, the generations to come? Do you have any thoughts about that?
The effect on the public in Japan?
Yes, exactly.
Well, they're very resilient in Japan. You know, obviously, they're the only country that's been hit with nuclear weapons. They bootstrapped themselves up and built their country up to a financial power. And I think it's going to take a long time to recover from this, but if there's anybody that can do it, it's certainly the Japanese.
What else have you got planned in support of the folks there?
Well, obviously, we'll be making donations continuously and trying to get friends and neighbors and everyone else to make donations as well. There's also talks of other shows to be put on to raise money, and I'd love to be involved in those as well.
Comedian Paul Ogata has family living in Fukushima. He performed last night at the Stand Up for Japan benefit at the Laugh Factory in Los Angeles. And he was nice enough to join us from our studios at NPR West. Paul Ogata, thanks so much. And our very best wishes to you and to your family and to
Thank
all those
so
who are affected by this.
Thanks.
Events in Japan have been followed by a string of tactless comments about the tragedy. People have drawn attention to themselves, run the gamut from the press secretary for Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour to the rapper 50 Cent. Comedian Gilbert Gottfried lost his job after tweeting a number of inappropriate jokes. NPR's Ned Ulaby wonders if something about Twitter makes it easier to cross the line.
Gilbert Gottfried was the voice of the Affleck Duck.
Affleck.
Affleck is an insurance company, and you'd think they would have known about Gottfried's liabilities.
And some people need to be reminded every now and then that, you know, not everything is funny.
Right. Gottfried became news himself after tweeting jokes that mocked Japan's tragedy. Most were vastly more vulgar than the ones anchors at ABC News read aloud.
Japan is really advanced. They don't go to the beach. The beach comes to them.
Tweeting almost begs for trouble, says James Poniewozik of Time magazine.
It's immediate. It's unmediated. If you're a celebrity, it's very easy for you to just get on and thumb something out without it going through your publicist.
Poniewozik even invented a word for the consequences. Twimmelation.
Twimmelation is the phenomenon of losing a job or becoming publicly disgraced over a quick, ill-advised tweet or a series of tweets.
But Gottfried was not ill-advised, according to another person in the business.
We as comics, I think, make those remarks deliberately.
Lisa Lampanelli falls squarely in the same hardcore insult comic camp as Gottfried, and she defended him on Twitter.
With comics like Gilbert Gottfried, Sarah Silver, and myself, anyone who has sort of a shock element to their comedy is almost even better because you get an immediate reaction out of people, and I think it's great. I think it makes our brand stronger.
This kind of comedy taps into the id. It's unfiltered, impulsive, all about immediate gratification. And what's Twitter but a sort of mass id? Much like stand-up. So you may be surprised to hear comedian Paula Poundstone say Twitter actually involves editing.
One of the things I do with Twitter that I certainly don't do verbally, I think of a joke, I write it up on the thingy, and I don't know how many characters it is until I write it out. Well, if it's too long, then I have to start hacking things away.
Of course, she struggles to keep the meaning.
I try to make punctuation the last thing I throw out.
So a comedian's tweets may be more thoughtfully processed than their off-the-cuff onstage jokes. Lisa Lampanelli says Twitter is deceptive. It feels like a big shared experience, but it's not like a comedy club where performers respond to audience reaction.
When you're on stage, there's the facial expressions, there's the tone of voice.
Lampanelli says there's one line, one, she refuses to cross. She will not say anything she doesn't think is funny. Neither will Paula Poundstone. She works for NPR, so she's practically by definition not an insult comic. But she's given this thought, too.
It's funny because I, in fact, put up a tweet that said, due to the tragedy in Japan, CNN has had to discontinue their Charlie Sheen coverage until the end of the hour. And somebody tweeted me back and said, oh, too soon.
That annoyed Poundstone. She was mocking CNN, not Japan. Poundstone says she has nothing to say about Japan that's funny. Neda Ulaby, NPR News.
Only fitting to introduce our next guest with a series of tweets. The social network inside Twitter is celebrating its 5th anniversary this year. Hashtag happy birthday. 3 exclamation points. Tweeting, of course, is like blogging, only faster and more stream of consciousness. Hashtag Gilbert Gottfried. Today, the service has over 200 million users who send over 100 million tweets every day. Are we a trending topic yet? Biz Stone is the co-founder and the creative director of Twitter. He joins us from the studios of On the Path Productions in San Francisco, where, of course, Twitter is based. Mr. Stone, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I sent out a tweet inviting Twitter users to ask any questions. You know what question I got by far more than any other?
I have no idea.
Why 140 characters?
Oh, right.
And?
I have a good answer for that.
Okay.
Well, from the very beginning, we built Twitter to work over SMS, or simple mobile text messaging. And so the limit internationally for text messages is 160 characters. So that meant we needed to fit all of our tweets within that limit, but we also needed to reserve room for the name of the author of the tweet. So we decided to standardize on 140 characters, and that way you can read and write tweets in their entirety on any mobile phone on the planet.
And why did you get the idea for Twitter?
Well, that's an interesting story because we weren't supposed to be working on Twitter. My co-founder, Evan Williams, and I had left Google together, and we were working on a new startup, and that startup was not captivating us as much as it should have been, really, for us to be taking a risk with other people's venture capital money. So my other co-founder, Jack Dorsey, came up with this idea that was actually not too far from something I had already tried twice unsuccessfully to launch, and that was a very simple way to update other people with a status message over mobile, and specifically text messaging. And we started talking about it with some others. We started getting excited, and it was actually Evan who said, why don't you guys just take 2 weeks and build a prototype, and we'll see if people like it. And at first, nobody liked it, really. People, for the first 9 months or so, just thought it was not useful. To which I recall Evan Williams saying, well, neither is ice cream. Should we ban ice cream and all joy? And the answer was no. We were having fun. We were emotionally invested in this because it was something that captivated and held our interest.
And how do you get from something that was just fun, like ice cream, to something that has been credited for at least playing a role in revolutions around the world?
You know, when I think about it, it really comes down to a very core basic belief of mine, which is that it really doesn't matter how sophisticated the algorithms get or how many machines we add to the network. If Twitter, you know, if it's to be a triumph, and if you want to call it a triumph, then it's not necessarily just a triumph of technology. It's a triumph of humanity. So how did we get here? We got here because people are basically good. They're basically smart. And when given a simple tool that allows them to express that, they'll prove it to you every single day.
Question from Rav Fox over Twitter. What's the actual business model for Twitter? I mean, how do you guys make money doing this?
Our business model is comes from something we're calling our promoted products, and that's promoted tweets, promoted trends, promoted accounts. The reason that these go somewhat unnoticed by people is that they're entirely native to the system. So a promoted tweet is really just like any other tweet, but a company like Starbucks, for example, can pay to have that tweet show up at the top of the other tweets when people search for, coffee-related terms. We're really just at the beginning of it. This is our revenue model for now, and it's by sort of invite only, the partners we work with at this point, and we're going to grow that as the year goes on.
Let me ask you about whatever role Twitter may have played in revolution in Egypt, in uprisings in Iran, in Libya, political movements around the world. At the same time, are there people who confuse sending a tweet with actually doing something?
No, I don't think there are. I think there are people that are arguing that there are people that are making that confusion, but I don't think anyone's really making that confusion. I think the key thing to remember is that, tools like Twitter are just that, they're tools. They're ways that people can coordinate activities, communicate with one another, and in this way come together as one when it's important to do so. And I'd be the first to admit that, you know, forwarding an email or sending a text message or writing a tweet isn't exactly the same as true activism, but it's in support of activism, and it helps. You know, when the Berlin Wall came down, I'm sure there were phone calls being made, but no one said that the telephone brought down the Berlin Wall, you know?
You mentioned that that when you and your partner were beginning Twitter, people asked, yeah, but what good is it? And you said, what good is ice cream? Can't you just enjoy it? Can you, at this point in your life, just enjoy tweeting?
Yeah, it's interesting. Tweeting for me has changed a little bit because what's happened over time is that I've switched from tweeting a lot to consuming a lot of tweets, and that's based on the idea that you don't have to build a web page to get value out of the internet, and the same is true for Twitter. You don't need to actually tweet to get value out of Twitter, and I've learned that to be true.
Mr. Stone, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Biz Stone, he is the co-founder and creative director of Twitter as the site marks its 5th anniversary. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.